From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the president takes on athletes who take a knee in protest during the national anthem. Sports commentator John U. Bacon weighs in.
When I coached high school hockey, our anthem was a very big deal. We stood, you did not move a muscle to one beat after the song ended, so I take this very seriously. And yet, I tell you fervently, if this becomes mandatory, it's not freedom.
Protecting our electric grid from hackers.
Everybody is seeing attacks. The question is, when does it become an incident you actually have to respond to?
A librarian's letters to books.
Dear Anna Karenina, I feel like I don't even know you. Maybe that's why I find it so difficult to say I've been seeing someone else.
Plus a Grand Rapids farm tucked into a shipping container. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up this hour, sports commentator John U. Bacon weighs in on President Trump's strong comments against NFL players kneeling during the national anthem.
I'm a student of sports history. I cannot recall any president on either side of the aisle ever advocating for employees be fired from private organizations based on their comments. That is new territory.
But first, Michigan's Republicans met through the weekend on Mackinac Island. Let's dig into what happened at the Mackinac Republican Leadership Conference as we say hello to our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Rick, who comes to the conference and officially to what purpose?
Well, officially and unofficially, it is a place for Republicans who have the interest and the means to make it up to Mackinac, to show up, to network, to strategize, to fundraise, and to party.
Okay, and I bet much of that was happening all weekend at Mackinac.
All of those things did indeed happen.
And all of that was happening on Mackinac. President Trump was busy firing off a tweet storm against athletes who choose to not stand during the national anthem, once more stirring things up. How much support did you hear for the president among Michigan's Republicans?
A lot. It wasn't front and center, but most of the speakers felt like they had to at least make some kind of a reference to the president and how glad he was in the White House and support for him. All the things that were playing out in the fighting between the president and the NFL and the players, all of that was kind of playing out as people were packing up to leave the island. And so more people probably heard about it on their car radios driving home than anything that they heard about on the island.
And I really think it's this continuation of the same thing that was happening during election 2016, right? Which was this sort of, he seems to work for our brand or for a specific group of supporters of our brand. And so there's this very kind of like, yes, okay, he's working for our brand, but we're not quite sure how to handle him and how to engage with him.
And did anyone talk about the fact that he has lobbed Twitter attacks on members of the Republican Party?
Well, and I think that continues to be, and supporters that I've heard over and over again, it continues to be this. We agree with his policies. We like, or in fact love, that what he's done to the Republican Party, at least in winning the White House in 2016. But we would really like if he would continue to focus on policy rather than getting in all of these dust-ups with groups that really are not helpful in trying to get this message that Republicans are trying to make.
Although the people who attend this tend to be more of the Republican donor class who kind of feel caught between a rock and a hard place. Yes, they want to express support for the president. They would also like to send a message that maybe they'd like to see less vitriol and fewer tweets. But at the same time, they know that Donald Trump remains, one, very popular with the Republican base, and two, a lot of that base is not unhappy with seeing Donald Trump feuding with congressional Republican leadership. They're kind of like rock on.
Because it is taking on the establishment. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what they see is this is part of the whole, drain the swamp.
But what about the reality that 8 months into a Trump presidency, he's not had a big legislative win? Who are they blaming for the Trump agenda not being launched, Zoe?
And I think this goes back to this conversation about when you look at like a Venn diagram, right, of who he takes on, who his supporters trust, what they believe. I mean, it's this sort of weird relationship, right, where, some supporters are really angry with Trump because he made a deal with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer initially about the debt ceiling. And others are going, no, he stuck it to, Republican establishment Senator Mitch McConnell and all the establishment folks. So it is a very interesting dynamic to watch where supporters come down. I was spending some of the time over the weekend. I decided to make my own diagram. diagram of Trump supporters. And I have this theory that you can kind of look at four different cross sections titles. And one is, you know, a true believer. One is the believer, but wishes he would tweet a little less. Others are users, right? That they don't necessarily believe in what he's talking about, but they want to jump on the Trump train because they think that that will be helpful for them in their own elections and campaigns.
Let's switch over to Michigan politics. Governor's race, Schutte versus Callie, won in the race, one thinking about entering, and the straw vote, Rick, went for?
Bill Schutte.
Was that a surprise to anyone?
No, although I think that Zoe and I were both struck at how this event was really kind of Schutte-owned.
This was Schutte's weekend.
Yeah. I mean, Patrick Kolbeck was certainly there trying to work the crowd.
Very conservative state senator who is running for governor as well.
Yeah, and there were certainly plenty of people wearing Kolbeck T-shirts and buttons and all of that. But Bill Schutte was there greeting people at the docks as they were getting onto the ferries, that he was working the porch and the lobby of the Grand Hotel. He was hitting the receptions and just walking around the island, and the line was out the door when he and his family took over the Grand Hotel's ice cream shop and started scooping out free ice cream.
Literally,
for the people who were attending.
Literally, he was scooping ice cream, and then the campaign was handing out free Schutte on duty ice cream scoops.
He called it Schutte's Scoop Shop.
Okay. What about the lieutenant governor? Where was Brian Kelly with all of this?
He was very quiet. He met with reporters, including me, talking about a series of town halls that he is planning going forward. He's saying don't count him out in the governor's race. But he was not the overwhelming presence at this particular event that Bill Schutte was. But remember that this isn't a group that necessarily decides a primary or even a general election campaign. These are Republican stalwarts. They tend to be more of the establishment wing of the party and very, very highly representative of the donor class of the Republican Party.
Zoe, what are the very clear rift between Governor Snyder and the Attorney General over prosecuting people like HHS Director Nick Lyons in the Flint water disaster? Didn't the governor even take a swipe at Mr. Schutte over this?
Yes, he did. I mean, this is this ongoing relationship. It's hashtag it's complicated, right, with these two Republicans. One, the current governor, Rick Snyder, who, you know, doesn't love the game of politics and really is more about policy, versus Bill Schutte, Republican Attorney General, who, yes, is big on policy, but just, you know, you can just see the love of politics in campaigning just coming out of his pores, right? He told us that it was, you know, this weekend and campaigning, it's like jumping into Lake Michigan on a hot day, he said. So, I mean, he just eats this up. So there's always been this tension. And now, you know, Attorney General Bill Schutte is taking on some administration officials who are in Governor Rick Snyder's cabinet. And so it is complicated. And so one of the things that the governor talked about to some of the reporters over the weekend is his concern that morale for state workers is hard right now because they're worried that they may be next, that if they make a poor decision or something like that, that they could be in the line of fire for the attorney general or whomever charges like that. He also took a little swipe. Schutte's main message is about winning and jobs. And Snyder did say something sort of like that about, you know, oh, we've got the jobs, you know, we're winning kind of thing. So it's playful, but it really represents some tension between these two Republicans.
Which, we're sort of touching on two distinct things, that if you get administration insiders talking candidly, that they believe that these Flint prosecutions are not just about justice for the people of Flint, and that there is a political motivation that's woven into the legal strategy as far as Flint. You know, there's that. And then there's the other one, which is that Bill Schutte is just a happy warrior when it comes to politics in a way that Rick Snyder and Brian Kelly and Patrick Kolbeck and others in the field just aren't.
Zoe, which GOP Senate hopeful has the most support in the quest to unseat Senator Debbie Stabenow?
And that is sort of this very interesting question right now, because on the island was West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton, who is right now a representative. But there is some talk that he may want to run in the U.S. Senate. The Republicans sort of championed to...
Much of that talk coming from Fred Upton.
From Fred Upton, right, that they would like him to defeat Democratic incumbent Senator Debbie Stabenow. And yes, he continued to fuel those flames of will he or won't he. I think the party in the primary has to really decide whether Upton is the proper candidate. You know, as I said, he is a congressman. He has been in D.C. He is as establishment as they come. Is that the wave that we're going to see in 18? And do you put an establishment candidate up against an establishment candidate like Debbie Stabenow? Or do you look at someone, an outsider like John James, who has declared, will he in the primary of Republican voters grab hearts? There's also former Supreme Court Justice Bob Young, who is sort of going after this voter with his new ad called Bow Tie Bad Butt. I will say it so that we can put it on the radio
on.
Today.
Really?
So, right.
We got it.
It makes the ad less bad if you have to say bad butt, I guess. But that is not what the ad says. So
you know what? If you can't say it that way, then you're just not.
Right. That.
I say go all in or don't. Anyway, but Bob Young, this is an establishment gathering.
Yes.
And Bob Young, the former state Supreme Court justice, mm-hmm. is the one who arrived on the island with a long list of establishment endorsements topped by former Governor John Engler, who, by the way, also endorsed Schuette while he was on the island. And so, therefore, at this establishment gathering, it should be no surprise that Bob Young is the one who came out on top in this, it should be pointed out, very unscientific straw poll.
Final few seconds. Rick, where's the biggest divide among Michigan's Republicans, do you think?
The biggest divide, I think, is among people who say that we need to go with someone who will appeal to the center and the right going into the general election versus the Trump true believers who say, nope, you've got to stick with the president and everything that he wants in order to win in November.
That, 1,000 times that. It's, you know, how do we deal with a problem or a man like Trump, I think, is really what it is for them.
Break out your Sound of Music soundtrack. Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up on the next idea, a Grand Rapids farm tucked into a shipping container.
It's an insulated 40-foot by 8-foot by 9-foot box that just happens to hold almost 2 acres of crop.
That's in 20 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to talk sports as we say hello to Michigan radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And John, before we get to scores, wins, and losses, this was a weekend where sports and politics were forced into an uneasy, tense mix through the issue of athletes taking a knee to protest racial injustice and the president denouncing them, saying those SOBs should be fired. What are your thoughts?
Well, I would say that if President Trump's goal was to rally his base, then it certainly did do that, as you see on Twitter and elsewhere. If his goal was to distract us from, let's see, healthcare, North Korea, the Russian investigation, also success on 1A today. They're talking about, of course, this very issue. So from his point of view, I suppose, it was probably a success. From the NFL's point of view, it's a nightmare. The last thing you want is divisions amongst your fan base or your players on the field, in the stands, watching on TV, and this is a very divisive issue, whether or not you stand for the national anthem or not. So I will say the flip side is the teams individually, as well as the NFL collectively, handled this with tremendous aplomb, giving the players the space they needed to do their thing if they wanted to, and not piling on with the SOB comment. And look, I've met a lot of these guys. They're not all mm-hmm. angels, but don't tell me they're SOBs. Mm-hmm. And that's where Martha Firestone, of course, Ford, widow of William Clay Ford Sr.,
yes.
She was seen also locking arms.
It was an image. I saw the photo. We were actually listening to the game driving up from Virginia, so we didn't see it. But I saw the photo of her, 92 years old, locking arms with Jim Caldwell, standing in line. A lot of the owners, only a couple, missed the opportunity to get behind their players.
Well, one thing you got to consider is this. The league is the majority of the players are African Americans. Yeah. And if you start picking that fight, you won't have a league. So think about that for a second there.
What was lost and gained here, do you think?
What was lost is, if you will, the hoary cliche, the innocence of football. It's not one thing that unites us mm-hmm. and so on. It's apolitical. It's beyond all this. It's not. The lines are now blurred. So that's been lost. What's been gained is a very strong response. Now, I say what I said earlier, knowing that my father served in Germany after getting his medical degree, volunteered for 3 years in the front lines of the Cold War. My grandfather in his 40s, a dentist, volunteered for a Navy ship in World War II. So I come from a very patriotic family. When I coached high school hockey, our anthem was a very big deal. You did not move a muscle till one beat after the song ended, so I take this very seriously. And yet, I tell you fervently, if this becomes mandatory, it's not freedom. And at that point, we're not who we claim to be. So it has to be voluntary. And the First Amendment's a real thing. Now, it doesn't engage with employers. I can't recall, I'm a student of sports history, I cannot recall any president on either side of the aisle ever advocating for employees to be fired from private organizations based on their comments. That is new territory.
All right. Let's go over to the Lions, the game. And I don't think...
Back to the trivial.
Back to the trivial. I don't think fans have picked themselves up off the floor after that sucker punch of an ending.
This one's complicated to explain. Yeah. The bottom line is Detroit got screwed yet again.
Certainly that seems to be the response on...
We have had a few conversations like this, Cindy, over a few years together. Here's how this crazy rule works. So with 12 seconds left, the Lions get the ball on the one-yard line. If they score a touchdown, they win. So they run a play. The play is called a touchdown. But then they review it with less than 10 seconds left. And the review comes back. It wasn't a touchdown. And then because you need 10 seconds, NFL rule, after one of these reviews to run a play, you have 8.5 seconds left or whatever it was, and you are done.
So the game is done.
The game ended in the video booth. And the dumb part about this is if the call went against Detroit initially, if it was not called a touchdown but called down on the one-yard line, you have 9 seconds left to run a play. Mm-hmm. These are NFL players. They can do that, and they probably would have scored, and they would have won the game. So by being called a touchdown earlier, being overruled through no fault of their own, they're screwed out of this. Once again, the Lions will be the source of a rule change in the offseason because this is absurd.
It's absurd. Did you expect the Lions to get so close to beating the NFC champs?
No, I did not. Look, the Atlanta Falcons were the NFC champions who played in the Super Bowl, of course, against the Patriots, which is never a good idea. It's a very good team still. And the Lions are right there, you know, blow by blow with these guys. So the Lions are better than expected, I'd have to say. And Matt Stafford up and down during the game, but he is the real deal.
All right. Tigers.
They're not.
They're not. Brad Ausmus.
And they're not going to be next year either.
Well, and we know Brad Ausmus has managed his last game at Comerica Park. He's going to ride out this week on the road, and he's out of here. So was the bigger problem the way Brad Ausmus managed this team in his time here? Or did he start with the deck stacked against him because of decisions made by Mr. Ilitch or Dave Dombrowski before he ever showed up?
Answer is yes.
To both?
It was all the above. And throw on top of that, Al Avila, the current guy running the team, making the choices for the personnel. I don't like his choices either. I think the whole thing has been a mess since Dombrowski left. Now, Dombrowski apparently became very unpopular with the front office. You did not see one kind word said about him on the way out. We noticed that on the radio year ago.
He made trades that the effects are resonating and not in a good way, didn't he?
He did. However, this last 10-year run is his. Okay. It's got to be said. It's Jim Leland, who was one hell of a manager. We've talked about him before, too. He's one of these salty old dogs who does not follow the new computer system for making decisions, and yet look at his teams, Pittsburgh, Florida, Detroit. All his players play their best years for him somehow. So for all the number crunching, there's still the intangible factor of, does my coach have confidence in me? Does he believe in me? And Brad Ausmus apparently did not have any of that because his players tend to have their worst seasons playing for him.
And now what?
And now what? It's now up to Al Avila to pick a new manager and to pick new personnel. So whether or not he can do the job, I was talking to my friend John Lowe this morning, who's covered 3,000 baseball games for the Detroit Free Press. He said, we're about to find out how good he is.
All right. Over to the good, the bad, and the ugly from Saturday, starting with the bad and ugly. What'd you take away from Michigan State's loss to Notre Dame?
Not the final score is bad and ugly, but I thought the Spartans played extremely well, actually, and despite the score, here's why. They outgained offensive yardage 429 yards to 348, a substantial chunk. Now, the scoreboard was way against them. They had three turnovers that got converted very quickly to touchdowns. So three plays cost you the game. However, D'Antonio's team played competitive football. They looked much better than last year, frankly. They're back to blocking and tackling. This is not a team going to compete for a Big Ten title. Let's be clear about that. But I think they're going the right direction.
They need seasoning?
They do need seasoning. It's a very young team, not as young as Michigan, but you lost a lot of big seniors last year. So if D'Antonio and Hollis stick together, and I bet they do, D'Antonio will get it going again sooner than later.
Finally, Michigan went over Purdue. What'd you take away from that?
Quarterback controversy, man. Mm-hmm. You had Wilton Spaten there for the fourth start of the season. He started all last year, did a very good job last year. This year has been shaky pretty much every game. Not horrible, but shaky, and Michigan fans are Michigan fans. They don't like that. He gets injured, and they bring in John O'Korn, who they thought was going to be the starter last year, and he was brilliant. 5 for 5 in the first drive, hitting tight ends, and they rack it up, of course, a very fine final score. So it looks good. Now you got a bye week coming up this week. So Wilton Spade almost certainly will be healthy by the time they play the Spartans in 2 weeks. Now, whom do you start? My guess is O'Korn, but who knows? If you start Spate instead of O'Korn, I would not be surprised if you get some boos in the big house. Not deserved, not fair, but that's the world we live in.
Michigan Radio sports commentator, John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
You've probably written a love letter or two, and maybe even a breakup letter. But have you ever written one of those letters to a book?
Dear the Time Traveler's Wife, I knew that I loved you, but I didn't remember the reasons. In public, when you came up in conversation, I spoke affectionately of you. But at home, I ignored you. It had been too long since I'd read you, and we'd become more like acquaintances than reader and book. But then something you'd said once popped into my head for some reason. It's the reality that I want. So I picked you up, walked you over to the couch, and really looked at you again. I stared straight into your insides, and I fell in love all over.
That's writer and librarian Annie Spence reading one of the letters from her delightful, fun, and thought-provoking book, Dear Fahrenheit 451, Love and Heartbreak in the Stacks. It's a librarian's love letters and breakup notes to the books in her life. Annie Spence has worked in libraries around the Midwest, and she now lives in Detroit. And it's a pleasure to say, Annie Spence, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
I just loved this idea of writing letters to books. So how long have you been dialoguing with the books in your life?
Oh, probably about 8 years, writing it down on paper, longer just in my head. But I think about 8 years ago, I was working at a library and we had a free table and the books on it just looked so sad. So sort of just to entertain myself, I wrote some breakup letters to them. I think the first one I wrote was to Pictorial Anatomy of the Cat.
I know. I love that.
That's fitting for a librarian.
Now, you're through this book, your love letters and breakup notes to books, we're learning about your life. And we also learn what it's like to be a librarian, which you beautifully, beautifully give us a sense of that as you write a love letter to Belle in Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, yeah.
Can you just kind of paraphrase that paragraph of what it's like when you're meeting the cheery townspeople in the library?
Oh, sure. Well, I was kind of comparing that opening scene in Beauty and the Beast when she's walking through and meeting the townspeople to a Friday morning at the public library when the doors open and they just come flooding in with all sorts of strange questions and requests. And I love it. But when you haven't had your coffee, it can come at you pretty quick.
Well, let's get a sample of one of the absolutely wonderful letters you've written. This one, I'd love if you would read us the one you wrote to Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. Would you do that for us?
Sure. Dear Anna Karenina, I feel like I don't even know you. Maybe that's why I find it so difficult to say, I've been seeing someone else. Geez, I'm sorry. I know I've led you on. I asked my friends about you. I checked you out more than once. You came home with me. You stayed for a month. But while you were on my coffee table, looking so earnest and so very long, Eleanor and Park by Rainbow Rowell was in my bed. Then some Megan Abbott mysteries, and then Dolly Parton's autobiography. Twice. I tried, I really did. Once I even picked you up and held you. I kept you on my lap while I watched The Bachelor. And you made me feel better, like I wasn't just some faceless citizen of Bachelor Nation. I read Russian literature, I thought to myself. I'm just smugly observing this show until the next commercial, when I will begin my scholarly analysis. But then I kept watching through after the final rose. Anna, I don't have one unkind word to say about you, because I haven't read you. Perhaps it's just not our time. There will come a day, probably, when I get a hankering for a bleak 864-page novel translated from Russian. But until that day, back to the shelves you go. I tried to look up goodbye in Russian, but it's really hard to spell, so just goodbye.
That is Annie Spence, Detroit writer, reading from her new book, Dear Fahrenheit 451, Love and Heartbreak in the Stacks. Give us an idea of some of the other titles of books that you send love letters to.
I send love letters to The Virgin Suicides, which is one of my very favorite books. Of course, there's a letter in there to Dear Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, which I feel like should just be a textbook for every librarian or person that loves freedom. So everybody, I guess. There's also some children's books. Matilda was really important to me when I was little. Misery by Stephen King, I had complicated feelings about.
It is complicated so, with that book, isn't it?
I wouldn't say it's a love letter, but it's something close to that. Dysfunctional love.
How about some of the ones who got breakup notes, and why did they get breakup notes?
There's some popular books, like Twilight, where as a librarian, I don't care what people read, just as long as they're reading. But when everybody is coming in reading Twilight and you know there are other books on the shelves that they would enjoy, that can get kind of frustrating. So there's the popular books that I had mixed feelings about. But when you're a librarian, you're not only in charge of building the library collection, you have to weed the collection and discard books that aren't going out anymore. And sometimes you'll find a whammy in there in the stacks that you just cannot imagine why anybody would have bought this for the collection. So there's some more sincere breakup letters to those.
And I will say it's worth the price of your book to read the blow-off letter you give to 50 Shades. I'm just going to put that out there for everybody. Also, the wonderful thing about your book, come for Annie's love letters and breakup notes, but stay for her chapters with book suggestions. You do have that librarian's gift for offering ideas, recovery reads, the books to turn to when you're on the mend from a book that gave you nightmares or left you in a dark headspace. Give us a couple of those ideas for the bedtime reading that you feel are good.
I always read YA for that because it's more plot-based. You can just get involved in the story and not details that are going to keep you up at night.
Thinking at 2 a.m.
Yeah. I know I mentioned her in the letter I read, but I really love Rainbow Rowell, who writes adult fiction and young adult fiction.
And I also loved your chapter on books for a partner that you don't think likes reading and to try to just get that partner moving along. Just wonderful, wonderful ideas. I'm looking forward to kind of exploring that. And I should note here, even if you have not read the books that Annie is writing letters to, you're going to love what she has to say to them. And you certainly will pick up titles to put on your reading list. Your book is a good reminder, Annie Spence, of what a library can mean to a community.
Sure.
Tell us more about what you've seen in your years working in them.
I just think a library can change a life, and it might do it in baby steps or it might do it in bigger steps, but I really believe that there's no other place you can go that asks so little of you and that gives so much. You can stay as long as you like. You don't have to have any money. You don't have to believe in a certain thing for the library to help you. And it's what we're there for. I'm always surprised at how grateful patrons are because I help them copy and paste or put an attachment on an email or print out their resume. They're so grateful, and I always want to remind them that's what we're here for. That's our job, is helping you, so come back.
And this era when the term fake news is being flung so freely about,
sure.
You feel like you really have to step it up?
Yeah, yes.
Up your game?
Yes. I think librarians have been saying it all along and helping people find legitimate information all along, but I think what librarians need to up our game in promoting that fact and being a louder voice.
Tell us a couple of secrets, Annie, that we civilians would never guess about libraries and working in them.
Well, I was talking to my coworkers last night, sort of swapping stories about this same thing. And one of my coworkers said that at another library, a patron returned a book, or a book showed up in the book drop that had a dead bat inside of it.
That was not in the job description.
Right. Whenever you start a job at a new library, you always sort of swap stories about, like, what you found in a book that was returned. Dead bat takes the cake, I think.
I think it truly does. What library do you work at now?
I work at the St. Clair Shores Library, and I also am a substitute at the Grosse Pointe Public Libraries.
And I know you've been really all around the Midwest, and
it
shows. This is just the most wonderful book, Dear Fahrenheit 451, Love and Heartbreak in the Stacks. And Annie Spence will launch her book Tuesday the 26th from 7 to 8 p.m. at Page's Bookshop on Grand River in Detroit. Annie will be at Literati in Ann Arbor Thursday the 28th, which should be a wonderful event. You are the very model of a modern librarian, Annie. Your book made me laugh out loud, and you've got me thinking of things that I could say to some of the books in my life. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this book and the great suggestions for future reading.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, with cybersecurity threats seemingly on the rise in both number and scale, just how close are we to experiencing a crippling attack on our power grid? We'll put that question and more to the man in charge of cybersecurity for Consumers Energy. That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
Since mankind first began growing crops, the farmers' enemies have been drought, wind, too much rain, wild temperature swings, curveballs served up by Mother Nature. Enter Brian Harris, our latest contributor to The Next Idea. He's turning out an array of green produce protected from the elements, and he's doing it in a converted freight container sitting right near downtown Grand Rapids. He calls this a hydroponic vertical microfarm. Its official name is Green Collar Farms, and it's a pleasure, Brian Harris, to welcome you to The Next Idea.
Glad to be here.
So what made you decide I'm going to build a farm and do it in a shipping container?
Well, it was evolutionary in the sense that I sold my business almost 3 years ago and was a little too bored and antsy, and a friend of mine said, hey, this indoor growing thing's happening big down in Florida. Why don't you check it out? And so he sent me some equipment, and I just played around with it. And over time, different iterations, different architectures came up with this assembly of stuff, and it happened to fit in a container. And I thought, well, let's give this a go.
So when we say a container, what are we talking about? Describe it.
Well, it's literally a ocean-going refrigerated shipping container. This one was built in 2004 and I think retired last year. It's an insulated 40-foot by 8-foot by 9-foot box that just happens to hold almost 2 acres of crop.
That's pretty stunning, almost 2 acres of crop. What are you growing?
This container is dedicated to cold crops, so it's a lot of leafy greens, lettuces, kales, pak choi, tatsoi, all sorts of good food.
Does it take a lot of water and energy?
No, actually, it's remarkable. Hydroponics in general is pretty conservative in water use because it's recycled. So we use about 10% of what a typical soil farm would use. We've eliminated all the furrows where wasted irrigation water just goes back into the conifers or the water system. And then what the plants don't consume is reconditioned and reused.
As far as cost, then, if you were to compare that to trying to grow crops on a traditional dirt farm, how do the costs compare?
You know, that's a great question, and it's a typical question, but it's very difficult to answer because the question is, are we talking about a mega farm where the tractors are guided by GPS? Or are we talking about a migrant farm where there's lots of labor? There's trade-offs. Our biggest cost is in energy. So we operate at peak about 82 kilowatts a day. But how to compare that to diesel fuel and tractor maintenance and labor and all sorts of other things that happen in the field, it's a difficult comparison.
Yeah, and you're able because it's protected, right? You can grow year-round?
Yeah, growing year-round. I mean, your opening was very true. I mean, Mother Nature is a cruel mistress in many cases, and whether it's natural climate or whether it's climate swings, we don't have to deal with anything. So there's no hail, there's no rainy season, there's no dry season. It is optimal environmental conditions for plants to grow. In fact, our crop cycle is about 7 weeks. So in other words, from germination to harvest is 7 weeks. We do that 365 days a year.
And how do your crops, Brian, that you're turning out from Green Collar Farms here in this converted shipping container, how do they compare to what you might get from a traditional farm where they are exposed to the elements and other conditions?
Yeah, well, nutrition studies have indicated that there's really very little difference between an optimal crop grown in the field versus what is grown hydroponically in this container or elsewhere. However, the stresses that the plants usually endure in the field require them to consume their own energy, which is what we think of as sugars and resins, and it can turn the product somewhat bitter or tough or whatever. And so everybody so far who's gone through here to taste this product has indicated that it is tenderer, it is not bitter, it's actually even a little bit sweet and not chewy.
So your greens have a nice, peaceful life, and they reflect that.
They are lazy. You know, because we know in the field they have to send out roots to go find all the nutrients, and that root growth takes energy. And so these fellows, ladies, and what, they just sit back, and the nutrients come right to them, so they can retain everything in the leaf and stem, and they live a good life.
What kind of other crops are suited for this kind of hydroponic vertical microfarm growing?
This is not an either-or proposition. That is, there are field-appropriate crops. You're not going to grow wheat. inside. It's not an apple orchard. You're not going to float cranberries. But there are many field crops that are consumed hyperlocally. So these lettuces and herbs, your basils. Hydroponics also lends itself to growing things like strawberries, snap peas, peppers, and so on and so forth. So there is quite a variety that can be grown indoors.
I'm wondering what kind of niche that you see something like this filling. What kind of needs could a container farm like yours meet?
You know, it has lots of applications. We're not trying to do commodity food, which needs to travel. I mean, I don't know if you knew, but your food travels more than you do. The average food mile in your pantry is probably 1,500, maybe 2,000 miles. But the products that we grow are typically consumed hyperlocally. You know, they don't have to travel a long way. So by being able to grow hyperlocally, you can improve access to food. There's all sorts of what I call, or what people call, STEM aspects, so science, technology, engineering, and math, to being able to control your environment. So I see educational opportunities for this. If you get some kids to come through and they see all the LED lights, which have that sort of pink glow to them, and they hear the whizzing and the whirling of the dosers and whatnot, I think they can really begin to be stimulated as not just where food comes from, but some of the ways that it can be grown. And maybe one of them wants to be a botanist or a farmer or an engineer or so on and so forth. So there's educational opportunities. It's franchisable in a way in that if you chose the, what I call the architecture of container, you could place these containers throughout an urban area where they would serve the local restaurants within, say, you know, a 10-mile radius or a 5-mile radius. And so you can create these little micro businesses around. My ultimate journey is really to scale up from the container to an actual brick-and-mortar warehouse somewhere in the urban core. A 10,000-square-foot facility would produce 65, 70 acres of crop every 7 weeks. And so now you're talking real jobs. You're talking real economic vitality.
And you're talking fresh, healthy food where often people don't have access to that.
Localized access, localized awareness, and then certainly the health and wellness benefits would follow.
Fascinating work. Brian Harris, Green Collar Farms of Grand Rapids. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us on The Next Idea, Brian.
My pleasure. Our motto is sowing seed daily. So it's not just the literal seed, it's the seeds of knowledge, of food and health and safety. Thanks for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Who remembers the great Northeast blackout of 2003? No power for parts of 8 states, including Michigan and a chunk of Ontario. Some 55 million people in the dark. It turns out that blackout was triggered by a tree that touched a high-voltage power line in Ohio. But those of us who lost power for those several days certainly remember how life ground to a halt. So imagine a monster blackout caused by a cyber attack. The security firm Symantec recently revealed a hacker group it calls Dragonfly 2.0 is behind a campaign of cyber attacks on energy companies in the U.S. and Canada, to the point where the attackers were able to get their hands on power grid operations. So let's see what one of Michigan's largest utilities is doing to fight cyber attacks and hacker-induced blackouts. Jim Beachy is Executive Director of Cybersecurity for Consumers Energy. Jim, thanks for being here today.
Pleasure to be here.
If we used the example of the doomsday clock with midnight being an all-out cyber attack on Michigan's major utilities, power's out, millions of us are in the dark, what time would the hands be at right now, do you think?
There's certainly been a very serious change in the threat landscape, and people are very concerned about cyber attacks against the electric grid. But one thing I can say very confidently is there have been no attacks against the grid to date in the U.S. that have impacted the power system. We certainly are taking these threats very seriously at Consumers Energy and really as an industry. Protecting those energy delivery systems as well as our customers' private data are top priorities for our company and our industry. You know, I think the threat is understood. It certainly has changed. I would give, you know, still about a halfway just because we haven't seen those attacks today. So maybe a 6 on that scale of 0 to 12.
Fair enough. Exactly how do you define cyber attack?
Cyber attack to us is when someone is attempting to do us harm, meaning they are trying to get into our environment, they are trying to steal company data or somehow impact the electric grid. That's an important delineation because an attack occurs on a regular basis, that elevates to what we call a cyber incident, meaning someone has actually gotten into our environment or our system. Those are important delineations because all of us see attacks every day, even at home on your, you know, on your cable modem at home. Everybody is seeing attacks. The question is, when does it become an incident you actually have to respond to?
Any sense how many cyber attacks that consumers' energy might get hit within a given period of time, a day or a month?
I think of this as almost like raindrops on an umbrella, if you will. We see sort of pings or communications at the door on a regular basis. It's kind of a constant barrage all day. But what we really focus on is those smaller number that are able to get into our environment. For your listeners, it's almost like an insect issue at home, right? Ants are going to get into the house at some point if the kids leave food out.
Sure.
And so same thing, cyber attackers are going to get into your environment. But if you can deal with that issue quickly and stop them before, let's say in the ant example, they, you know, infest the house and are burrowing in your walls, you can be successful at cybersecurity. So that's what we really focus on, is how quickly can we detect them and how quickly can we remove them from the environment.
And as you say, at this point, we have not seen a successful shutdown. They haven't gotten in to the grid to be able to do what we all fear.
That's correct.
How far have they gotten?
There are examples in the U.S., and obviously this article that Symantec has reported on posed some examples where Symantec believes that they were able to take screenshots of what we call a control system. Now, the challenge we're having as an industry is no specific examples were given, and you know, I can say at Consumers Energy that we were not impacted, nor were these attacks successful against us. And candidly, our industry partners and some of our information sharing groups, other companies did not see these as well. So one of the things we're trying to figure out is what can we learn from this with the limited information that is out there.
And we hear Symantec talking about this hacker group that it calls Dragonfly 2.0. With that group and even more broadly, what's your sense of who's behind these attacks?
Yeah, it's really difficult. This is one of the really important things for your audience, I think, is we just say attribution, meaning who is actually behind this, is really, really difficult. So, you know, thinking about who is writing computer code and trying to analyze it and figure out who's behind it, very difficult scenario. Most of the time, though, these advanced attacks are conducted by some kind of a group, which we call a nation state, meaning someone who is either funded or supported by a country, meaning they have a lot of resources, they have a lot of capability. Because these attacks are so advanced, they require more resources than sort of a small group of attackers who might be going after, you know, someone's credit card data or something like that.
I'm speaking with Jim Beachy, who's Executive Director of Cybersecurity for Consumers Energy, as we find out what one of Michigan's biggest utilities is doing to fight cyber attacks and hacker-induced blackouts. How much does an energy provider like Consumers spend on cybersecurity?
I won't go into sort of the specific dollars, but I can tell you we have invested heavily in cybersecurity. We have a robust program, both cyber and physical security. I've got a team of around 70 people that are focused on this issue. We have people that are daily, their sole job is monitoring our networks, looking for problems. We have people who are building security. So as we deploy things like a smart grid infrastructure, we're making sure those systems are secure. So Consumers and really energy companies in general have certainly invested heavily and continue to build more and more mature programs.
What kind of coordination, Jim, happens among energy providers in Michigan?
Yeah, it's one of the beautiful things about our industry is we share information regularly. So I can tell you that my teams that are watching for things, they will call the folks at DTE who do the same work. Did you see this? We saw this. Did you see it? What do you think about it? But even more broadly, nationally, we have groups set up to coordinate and share information, both in the industry in general, but more importantly, with the federal government as well, where we can get more sensitive information or the government can share the things that they are seeing and we can share the things that we are seeing. The reality is the attackers are actually pretty good at sharing information. So as defenders, we need to be, frankly, better than they are and be more willing to share information back and forth.
Jim, what about the effectiveness of cybersecurity laws, either at the state or federal level? I mean, can they really help when the hackers are God knows where?
You know, it's tough from a legislative standpoint. I think regulations do a good job of providing sort of a baseline of requirements, meaning sort of the lowest common denominator, if you will. But the challenge is these threats change so quickly that it's really difficult for legislation to keep up. So it's really best that individual companies are analyzing the threats that they're seeing and the vulnerabilities they have in their system, and they're moving and adapting quickly. We think of compliance in our organization as something we need to do. It's important. We obviously want to comply with law, but we sort of see it as the baseline. It's not what we aspire to. If your listeners have heard of ransomware attacks that have happened recently where organizations, their data is held hostage and, you know, a company has to pay a certain amount of money to get that data freed up, we didn't even see these attacks broadly 2 years ago. So the rapid change of technology, but even in the security realm, it moves that much faster.
Jim, what do you personally see as the most important steps or initiatives needed to protect our energy grid from cyber attacks and hackers?
Yeah, that's a great question. Tough issue to solve in one thing, but I believe the most important thing is continued information sharing and transparency between utilities, but also from the federal government to the private sector. We call them private-public partnerships. There's always a concern that bad news is going to get out in the community or get out in the news, and unfortunately, things are going to happen, and we need to be able to share that data with peers and partners so we can learn from each other and be able to respond to these things quickly. So I think that number one thing is continuing that information flow back and forth.
How do you feel Michigan compares, Jim, with other states in being prepared, being well guarded against hackers and cyber attacks? I guess, in short, how worried should people in Michigan and Michigan officials be about a cyber attack on our utilities?
We feel very good about where we're positioned today at Consumers Energy. We have a robust program, and what we do is we take what's called a defense-in-depth approach. So when your listeners are thinking of their computer, when we have a machine that is capable of doing something on the electric grid, we do simple things like it doesn't have internet access. It does not have email. If an operator needs to do those kinds of functions, they're doing that on a different machine. Those systems are highly separated from our corporate network. So, you know, without going into the technical details, we do a lot to make sure that those systems are properly separated and protected from the grid. And I think Michigan is well positioned from what we see at Consumers, from what I know is going on at the state level, and certainly our utility partners around the state.
Jim Beachy, Executive Director of Cybersecurity for Consumers Energy. Jim, thanks so much for being with us today on Stateside.
You bet. Thank you for the time, Cynthia. Take care.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and Danny Henzel. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.